Hi, I'm Ryan Penny, and welcome to The Catholic Sphere. A little over a month ago, the world watched for the long-awaited canonization of now Saint Pier Giorgio Frassati and Saint Carlo Acutis. It's so good to finally be able to say that. Today, we're bringing back two experts on the lives of the two saints. First, we have founder of Frassati USA and author of Finding Frassati and Following His Path to Holiness, Christine Wohar. She's joining us today from Nashville, Tennessee. We also have EWTN News Rome correspondent and author of the book, Carlo Acutis, A Saint in Sneakers, Courtney Mayers. She joins us today from the EWTN Vatican Bureau. Last time, we talked about now Saint Pier Giorgio Frassati and Saint Carlo Acutis to give our audience background on their lives and the process of their canonizations. And today, I want to focus on how their lives can inspire us and draw us closer to God. Christine, what first drew you to Saint Pier Giorgio Frassati?
I'm sorry, Ryan. Saint Pier Giorgio Frassati. That's awesome to hear you say that. It's so awesome. Pier Giorgio, I was introduced to Pier Giorgio by my priest when I moved to Nashville, but I would say that the thing that is the most appealing for me always has been is that Pier Giorgio didn't do anything extraordinary. Pope John Paul II said that he shows us in the normality of his existence that we can be holy through our studies, our sports, our social encounters, and so on. And so, you know, I coach sports, and I'm from a big family, lots of brothers, and the key to success in sports is practicing the fundamentals daily. And that's what I love about Pier Giorgio. He showed us that if we do the fundamentals of the faith, and we do them consistently and with discipline, then we can have this kind of result. Maybe we won't be officially canonized, but we can be holy, live for Christ in the midst of the world and not be of it. And he did those things, daily mass, frequent confession, loved the Blessed Mother, prayed the rosary. He did an incredible amount of works of charity. And, you know, he was a great guy, a good friend, a good Catholic man, 24/7. And they said nobody ever laughed at Pier Giorgio because he was who he was all the time. So when I look at Pier Giorgio Frassati, I say, I can do that. It's a level of sanctity, a level of holiness that I can aspire to and, with God's grace, achieve.
That he was extraordinary, and yet he was so normal. And yet Pope John Paul II called him not just a holy man, but he was a man of the Beatitudes. And that is something that is within our reach if we simply live the Catholic faith with the sincerity that he lived it. So, Courtney, what first drew you to the saint in sneakers?
Well, one of my favorite parts of my job as a Vatican correspondent is reporting on the inspiring lives of people on their way to sainthood. And I remember vividly the first time that I encountered Carlo's story. I was just fascinated by the fact that there was a computer coding teenager born in the 1990s who liked video games and Super Mario, but also had this tremendous love and devotion to the Eucharist and was on the path to sainthood. And when I had the chance to report on Carlo's beatification mass in Assisi 5 years ago, it was clear that there had never been a canonized saint quite like Carlo. And when you visit his tomb in Assisi, you see the body of a 15-year-old boy who's dressed in jeans, a track jacket, and Nike sneakers. He is the first computer coding saint in the history of the Catholic Church, and he offers us an incredible example of just what holiness can look like in the 21st century.
Amazing, yes. And Christine, Saint Pier Giorgio Frassati had a deep connection with the poor, much grander than his family thought, because when he died, 10,000 people turned out to his funeral that the family had never met before. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Right. I think people who know just the bare minimum about Saint Pier Giorgio, they identify two things with him. One, those beautiful pictures of him on the mountains. He was a great mountaineer. He loved the mountains and said he would have spent his entire days in the mountains contemplating the goodness of the Creator. And the second thing are his incredible works of charity. Pier Giorgio joined the St. Vincent de Paul Conference when he was 17 years old. There were a lot of displaced veterans coming back from World War I. There was tremendous poverty. And so he was known as a guy with empty pockets. He was always broke because he was doing so much for the poor. He also was known as a guy that had pockets full of names and addresses of poor. And he would ask his friends to help him, and he would say, meet me at 6 o'clock beneath the Consolata clock. And they would set off on these adventures into the poorest areas of Turin. His friends would say, how can you stand it? The smell, you know, the stench. And Pier Giorgio said, never forget that when you go into the home of someone like that, you are encountering Christ. And he did that so often that, as you say, when he died, thousands of people came to the funeral. His funeral was 2 days after his death. There was no social media, no way other than the word spreading like wildfire and in the paper that this young man had died. The poor did not know he was the son of this influential family. And his family had no idea the extent of the poor that he had reached. They knew he did works of charity, and they did themselves. But his father said to his mother, we did not know our son. And so that was really an aha moment in the beginning of his canonization, to see that outpouring of so many people who, if you can think, he died at the age of 24. So in, let's say, 7 short years, he had touched that many people's lives that they poured out into the streets, giving up maybe their day's wages, their food that they would have, you know, maybe relied on earning that day, just to pay homage to this young man who they only knew. He didn't use his family name. He did things anonymously, or he said his name is a confrere of the St. Vincent de Paul Conference. So they said, if you needed something, go to Frassati. But sometimes his friends had to spot him the money even to go on hiking trips or ski trips because he was always broke. So his family didn't understand that at all. But when they saw, I think, that outpouring on the day of his funeral, it was transformative for them and did shape, I think, the rest of his parents' lives.
Well, they say that a great way to model your life is to think about what you want people to say about you at your funeral. So whenever I think about that, I'm like, well, there's no better model of that kind of strategy in life than now Saint Pier Giorgio Frassati. So Courtney, Saint Carlo left a lasting effect on those around him too. Can you tell us about how he evangelized to those closest to him?
Yes, my book is filled with testimonies from Carlo's classmates, friends, and family members as to how he brought them closer to God, including an entire chapter on the story of a man who converted from Hinduism to Catholicism after getting to know Carlo. His name was Rajesh Mohair, and he worked for the Kudus family as an au pair when Carlo was young. And part of his job was helping to bring Carlo to and from school. And as a part of that, he would also bring Carlo to daily mass. And he would sit in the back of the church and watch this young boy pray so reverently and observed how Carlo's behavior changed as soon as he entered the church and was in front of the tabernacle and prayed there in silence with such devotion. And while Carlo was still an elementary school student, he taught Rajesh how to pray the rosary and told him about the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist. But I will say one of the things that Rajesh told me that impressed him most as a non-Christian was the witness, similar to Pier Giorgio Frassati, of Carlo's care and concern for the poor and how he interacted with the homeless man who would sit at the entrance of the church and would ask his parents if, you know, they could help him fill up Tupperwares of food to hand out to the homeless. And Rajesh's baptism was a great moment of celebration and really a triumph for young Carlo, who even suggested that they all go out for Chinese, that they get Chinese food to celebrate, which is one of Carlo's favorite foods. Another thing that I think many people might not realize that's remarkable about Carlo, you know, having been canonized and only having lived to the age of 15, is that Carlo's parents were not practicing the faith when he was born. You know, many might assume that he came from a devout family, but that just wasn't the case. He was actually introduced to the Mass and the Rosary and other devotions by his Polish nanny, and really just showed this great attraction and love for the faith at a young age. But Carlo was also a very curious young man, and so as he grew older, he kept asking so many questions about the Catholic faith to his mother that she had to seek out help of the priest to get catechized herself so that she could answer Carlo's questions. And slowly, as she learned more about the faith and more of the why kind of behind Catholicism, and the witness of their son's enthusiasm for the faith drew Carlo's parents back to the church, so much so that Carlo's mom calls him my little savior. Wow. So it's just amazing to see how this young boy could lead adults to have a, you know, complete conversion, return to their faith.
And this is where we start seeing more of a connection between St. Pier Giorgio Frassati and St. Carlo Acutis, in that they both came to love our Lord at such young ages, even though their parents were not devoutly practicing the Catholic faith. And then they ended up having such a profound impact on their parents and those around them. And so, Christine, let's talk a bit about St. Pier Giorgio and his father. So, Pier Giorgio and his father didn't share the same faith for the most part when Pier Giorgio was growing up. Can you tell us about that relationship and how his father eventually found his way back to the sacraments?
Yes, Ryan, I have to say I just enjoy hearing Courtney's story so much because there is such an incredible parallel between these two young men, even to this point, about leading their families back to the faith. And you see at the root of it all was their love for the Eucharist, because Pier Giorgio said, Jesus comes to me every day in Holy Communion, and I repay him in my miserable way by visiting the poor. So it was that love of the Eucharist and being fed by the Eucharist that made them both, you know, why we're talking about them today. In Pier Giorgio's case with his father, they had the same faith. His father was, I think it's best to think of him as a fallen away Catholic. The books, because of translations and adaptations, you'll read he was agnostic or atheist. But Mr. Frassati was, raised Catholic. He wasn't practicing the faith. I have a theory for politically why that might have been expedient for him as well. And at the time of Pier Giorgio's death, his parents were on the verge of a legal separation. Following Pier Giorgio's death, his father did come back to the faith, and his niece, Pier Giorgio's niece, Wanda, told me that even as a young girl, she remembers being in church with her grandfather, Mr. Frassati, and, you know, misbehaving like a child would do, and him pulling her down to sit her back down into the pew. So he returned to the sacraments. He ended up having a beautiful correspondence with Cardinal Montini up until Mr. Frassati's death in 1961, and Cardinal Montini, you know, becomes Pope Paul VI. So even before his, let's say, reclamation or reversion to the faith, Mr. Frassati was defending the Jesuit fathers in his newspaper. They had nuns in the home and all. But he admired his son. He knew he wasn't like him. There was a misunderstanding of why this young man was spending so much time in church and not pursuing all of these wonderful opportunities that the family afforded him. But that deep admiration he had for his son and the great pain that he felt after his son's death, I think, you know, lit a little fire in him that brought him back to the fullness of the faith after Pier Giorgio's death.
It's a beautiful relationship that we get to see between a father and a son. And Courtney, let's talk about St. Carlo's love of Eucharistic miracles. Can you tell us how all of that got started for him?
Well, Carlo's spiritual director attested that Carlo was personally convinced that the scientific evidence from Eucharistic miracles could be persuasive in helping to awaken people to the reality of the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist and help them to come back to the Mass. And so that was really the inspiration behind the Eucharistic Miracles exhibition that Carlo worked on with his family for 2.5 years. And the exhibition actually premiered during the Church's Year of the Eucharist, proclaimed by John Paul II, and has gone on to be displayed in thousands of parishes on 5 continents. And The Eucharistic Miracles Project was really something that allowed Carlo to use his computer skills and internet savvy to research information about different Eucharistic miracles around the world. He also traveled with his family to several Eucharistic miracle sites in Europe and helped to take photos for the exhibition. I'll mention one of Carlo's favorite miracles, which was one that took place in the Italian town of Lanciano, in which there was a monk who was full of doubts as to whether the consecrated host was actually the body of Christ. And one morning while offering the Mass and he was holding up the host, it changed into flesh. So that's what we're really talking about when we talk about these Eucharistic miracles. And the reason why Carlo was so interested in this miracle in particular was because there have been scientific analyses that have been conducted on this transformed host that has survived for centuries. And one study found that the sample from the transformed host is actually cardiac tissue, and that the blood belonged to the same AB group as that has been documented on the Shroud of Turin. So it's really incredible witness to what the Church teaches about the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist. And it's been beautiful to see how that has continued to spread after Carlo has died, and the Eucharistic Miracles website, you know, lives on.
Yes, and it's amazing that Carlo Acutis was among the first to use the internet, which, as we all know, was started and used to promote very bad things. But holy men like Carlo Acutis were using it for the greatest good. And we see even today these Eucharistic miracles, when we post about them on EWTN's channels or on social media especially, they're some of our most popular and loved content that people like to see. So Carlo Acutis knew how powerful they could be, and the evangelical power that they wielded, and he wasn't shy about sharing it with people. And Christine, St. Pier Giorgio Frassati was also never one to shy away from his faith. He even spoke at a Eucharistic Congress when he was 22, just a few years before his death. Can you tell us about the impact that he made?
I actually don't remember him speaking at the Eucharistic Congress, but he did attend several. That was a big thing that was important to him. He sent postcards to his mother from the Eucharistic Congress. But I do know at 22, he did give a beautiful speech to the Catholic youth of Polone, the little village where the family had their summer home. Mm-hmm. And in that particular these Catholic youth clubs, they had a flag, like a banner, and they would make somebody the godfather of the flag. So Pier Giorgio was the godfather. And because of that role, he was giving this speech. It's reprinted in the book of letters compiled by his sister Luciana, which I was able to edit several years ago. And in that speech, Pier Giorgio says to the young people, "I urge you with all the strength of my soul to feed on this bread of angels, from which you will find the strength to fight all of these inner battles and struggles." So Pier Giorgio believed in three apostolates, and he lays them out in that particular speech. And he says, first, you basically have to get your life in order, is what he says. You have to be getting, you know, to the sacraments yourself. And then after that, then you can throw yourself into these three apostolates, which I think sum up his spirituality beautifully. He said the apostolate of good example. We're supposed to be 24/7, you know, faithful, upstanding, moral people. He said the apostolate of persuasion, to go among your friends and show them to follow the ways of God. Yes, there may be thorns, but it's strewn with roses as well. And the apostolate of charity, which he lived out until his dying days, which probably ultimately is why his life was cut short. So he would encourage his friends to go to the sacraments. He did fun things like it challenged them to a game of pool, or a race down the mountain, where the prize would be if he won, that they would do some kind of spiritual practice, like go to Mass or pray the rosary or things like that. So he was always looking for gentle ways to bring people to his friends to the sacraments. He would write letters to his sister encouraging her to go to the sacraments. And of course, he went on a daily basis from when he was 12 years old. So his love for the Eucharist was the source of everything in him, I believe. And he never shied away, as you said, from trying to draw others to that. Even at Pier Giorgio's time, they said to make the sign of the cross in public would have been something that made you look like a moron or a radical. And Pier Giorgio was known to ride his horse through town, and the horse would even almost look like it was genuflecting, because he would stop to make the deep sign of the cross, a very reverent sign of the cross, because Jesus was present in the Blessed Sacrament in the tabernacle in that church. So he wasn't trying to be something he wasn't. He was just who he was, and that's actually one of my favorite stories. Pier Giorgio was leaving church with the rosary in hand, and a friend said, "Oh, you've become a fanatic." And he said, "No, I have remained a Christian." So that was just a part of him, and it all came from the Eucharist, and he was never afraid to be a Catholic man, wherever he was, inside or outside of the church.
Tremendous. Tremendous. And I cannot stress enough how normal these now saints appeared during their lives. They both had pets. They spent time with their friends. Saint Pier Giorgio smoked cigars and climbed mountains and pulled practical jokes. Saint Carlo played video games and coded and wore Nike sneakers and ate Chinese. They are fantastic role models for young people to look up to. But Courtney, the internet looks very different now than it did when Saint Carlo was alive. He died even before the first iPhone came out. How can young people see his use of the internet as relatable and admirable?
That's exactly right, Ryan. Carlo Acutis died in 2006. So that was not only before the iPhone, but also before Instagram or TikTok. When I speak to young people, I say he barely lived to see the first viral cat video on YouTube. Yet his life continues to resonate. So many young people that I spoke with at the Jubilee of Youth told me about the many ways that they find Carlo relatable and how they are inspired by his witness. One young man told me that after hearing Carlo's story for the first time, he started to attend daily Mass. And so I think that young people also in today's age need to understand that they have this heavenly intercessor now to help them stay faithful in today's complex digital age, because social media and all these things do pose an even greater challenge, you know, than what Carlo faced. And I think at the heart of it, Carlo's witness shows us that the road to holiness and joy runs through the sacraments, no matter your generation. I think that prayer was truly a great secret of Carlo's life and sanctity. Prayer and the sacraments helped Carlo to keep his priorities straight and to see the world in its proper perspective. And he really rooted his life in the sacraments, which helped provide him with the graces he needed to approach technology in a healthy way. And it's a beautiful message of his story is that these graces are also available to all of us today.
Yeah, it's like he's a witness to the fact that, yes, this technology can be very alluring and it can be very distracting, but if we have the weight of grace flowing through our souls from the sacraments and prayer, then we can have the strength that we need to not only not let it ruin us, but for us to be able to wield it as a tool for the great benefit of the kingdom. So, Christine, I mentioned in our last conversation how a biography of Blessed Pier Giorgio Frassati was the first book that was ever given to me as a young teenager about the life of a saint. And I remember thinking, like, how fun and cool he seems to be, but also very intense. And I'll never forget when I first heard the story about how he deliberately chose not to pursue the girl that he was in love with because he didn't want to offend his parents. And he chose to make that sacrifice, and I did not. My young, very romanticized teen mind just could not understand that or relate to it. How did he have the strength to do something like that? And how did he find his true vocation before his death?
Yeah, in fact, it's funny you mentioned that, because the story of his love for this young lady, Laura Hidalgo, it's been asked so many times to me, and it's also been written about so many times, like, not accurately. And I've probably had more conversations about Laura with Pier Giorgio's niece than maybe any other topic. I think in those days there was this beautiful concept called courtship, and Pier Giorgio, although he was developing these feelings for her, he was being very impartial, so he'd write a note to Laura, he'd write one to Tina, and so on. So it's said that when Pier Giorgio died, Laura didn't have any idea that he had that much of a deep feeling for her. Now, someone else said to me, a woman always knows. She had to have known that he felt that way. And if you see pictures where they're both in them, you could see that, you can, you know, feel that maybe coming through the picture. I don't know. But he was very careful to guard her heart, to keep even his emotions toward her pure. And so when he made that decision, it was because he knew that his parents were on the verge of a legal separation. And he said, what good would come from building a new relationship on the ruins of another? He knew that that would probably be the last straw in his parents' relationship. It was very hard for him. If you read his letters, especially during the end of his last year of life, at the beginning of that 1925, a jubilee year, you really see he's pouring out his heart on that. And so, you know, he was at a time where he wanted to be in the mines as an engineer, but he died. His father wanted him to be a newspaper guy. Pier Giorgio, people say, did he want to be a priest? He considered it probably just casually, like a lot of young Catholics do, but he saw that a Catholic priest in Italy could not go among the poor like he would have wanted. And his best friend, Marco, said that he never seriously considered that vocation. So I think he had, you know, he was at the finishing his 6-year college degree. It was taking him that long. He was struggling with these emotions for a young lady, and he was facing the fact that his father did not want him to pursue his career as a mining engineer. So there's a lot of open-endedness of what would have happened if Pier Giorgio had lived even one more year, what would have happened. But I think his vocation was definitely above all things. He would have continued his life of service to the poor around him. He would have been a terrific friend, you know, a wonderful son and brother, and a great Catholic, a great citizen of Italy, no matter how that would have played out through marriage or I don't think he would have become a priest, but he was a lay Third Order Dominican, mm-hmm. so he would have continued with that spirituality as well.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yes, it's amazing what peace and grace and patience that he had. And continuing this theme, Courtney, of vocational discernment, so St. Carlo, when he was still a high school student, was beginning to discern a possible call to the priesthood. Do you think if he were still alive today that he would be a priest?
Yeah, that's right. Because Carlo was only born in 1991, it's kind of fun to think about where he might be today if he hadn't died of cancer in 2006. Carlo Kudis would be 34 years old today. And I think when you think about he had such devotion to the real presence of Jesus in the Eucharist and the Mass, that there's a good chance he would have been drawn to the priesthood. And he actually did have conversations with his mother in the summer before he died about how he was thinking about becoming a priest. But of course, God had other plans for his life.
Well, he may not have become a priest, but he is now a saint. And thank God that we can finally call them Saint Pier Giorgio Frassati and Saint Carlo Bacutis. We rejoice in this moment. It's tremendous. Christine and Courtney, thank you so much for joining us for this conversation today. And thank you for joining us. Don't forget to join us right here next week on The Catholic Sphere.